Welcome to CFRI Cystic Fibrosis Community Voices, a video podcast series created by and for the cystic fibrosis community.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here. I first became aware of CFRI when I served in the Center Committee. Center Committee, if you don't know, is a committee of the CF Foundation, which does accreditation visits across the CF centers around the U.S. And one of my site visits was to Stanford. It was about 10 years ago or so. And as I was touring the adult center, became aware. I'd heard of CFRI, but I got a firsthand knowledge of the impact that CFRI had, not just the Stanford program, but sort of generally. And so I've kept sort of in touch or been aware of what CFRI has been doing over the years. And I always look at I live in Chicago, so it's kind of hard to make it out to San Francisco too often. But I've been aware of the conference and the speakers that come and the program every year. And it looks like such an amazing conference. And it's really an honor when I got an invitation from Siri to come this year to present to you guys. So let me just load up my talk and we can get started. I'm going to take you on a journey today, a journey that's not completed yet. But I want to walk us through like where we came from and where we're going. Okay. And Siri talked about imagination and hope. And I think those themes come through what's happened in CF over the last, well, I've been involved for, you know, over 20 years, but I think if you go even further back, you can see that this is a situation where people have had imaginations and the hope has persisted and continues to evolve and increase, I think. And so the journey today will sort of start a little further back. We'll walk through what's been happening over the last 5 to 7 years and then look towards the future to see what we can look down the road. I urge you that if there's something, I have a lot of slides that have data in them. If there's something's not clear, it's confusing, I'd urge you to raise your hand and I'm happy to take questions as we go along. And we should have a little bit of time at the end for questions as well. So I've got my relevant disclosures there. And why don't we get started? So this is a slide that many of you are probably aware of already. CF is a genetic disease, autosomal recessive caused by mutations in CFTR. There's about 75,000 people, we estimate. We don't know exactly, but that's a good estimate, predominantly in North America, Europe, and in Australia. The underlying pathophysiology affects virtually every organ, whether primarily or secondarily. And if you want to think about it very simply, it's that the secretions of the various organs on Earth are more viscous, thicker, and that leads to problems with organ dysfunction and destruction over time. Now, if you look at the certain databases, you can see that there's over 2,000 mutations which have been described to lead to CF. These mutations reside on chromosome 7, you need two mutations to get the disease. But most patients can be described by having a handful of mutations. So even though there's all these 2,000 mutations, the vast majority of patients have a small group of these mutations. Now, in trying to understand how CF leads to problems and the treatments that we have, it is, I think, worthwhile to go through this kind of a diagram to understand what happens with gene mutations. And so we start with a gene defect with CFTR, which leads to abnormal protein function. And it's important to keep that in mind, that it's the gene that's a problem, but it leads to a protein that doesn't work in a normal fashion. And we think what's important about the protein is that it normally allows chloride to move back and forth. And this movement, whether primarily or its effects in other things, lead to a depletion of the airway surface liquid. And this, what this refers to is that in the airways of the cell, there's a small, tiny layer of fluid, which is really important, the composition of it and how big it is in terms of maintaining our airways to be functioning as well as possible. And when this doesn't work normally, you set up this sort of defective mucociliary clearance. You know, we don't think about our lungs being infected, but we breathe in bacteria, various organisms, dust particles, and our airways are very adept at keeping that sterile. But this system breaks down in CF, and that's what sets up the cycle of infection, mucus obstruction, and inflammation, that sort of vicious cycle that we talk about, which can lead to the development of bronchiectasis, which is a technical name for what happens in the CF lung. And then on the right part of the slide, you can see the treatments that have been developed. Some are being developed, some have been used historically for a long period of time. And so times are changing, as Bob Dylan sang many years ago. And what I've shown you here, sort of reference to that, is a timeline with regards to the treatments and various milestones that have occurred in CF. And then in the red curve there, we see what has happened with expected survival for CF patients. The first thing I want you to note is that the expected survival for CF patients has been increasing continuously for the last 70 years. The latest data from the CF Foundation Registry suggested that the median expected survival now is 47 years of age. And so let's walk through some of the treatments that we've implemented over the last 70 years that have led to this improvement. So the first big movement was with pancreatic enzymes, started in the late 40s. Then we got into effective airway clearance. Development of antibiotics, whether it was for staph or pseudomonas. Then there was a development of DNAs, which helps to break down the mucus that these patients develop. Inhaled antibiotics, whether it's tobramycin or inhaled castin, inhaled aztreonam. Newer formulation of enzymes, hypertonic saline, azithromycin. So these are all things that you are familiar with or will become familiar with that is important in the treatment of CF patients. And these have combined to improve the survival of CF patients. It's also important to remember as we think about this is that most care of CF patients is delivered through accredited CF centers. These are centers of excellence of professionals who are expert in managing various aspects of CF care. And this has also been a contributing factor into why survival has continued to improve. Not just survival, but quality of life has also improved for our CF patients. And we expect this to continue. So I want to take a step back and think about 1989. So what happened in 1989? Well, the San Francisco 49ers won the Super Bowl. Was anybody here to watch that? Yes, all right. That was a big thing, I guess. And it looks like the 49ers are getting better again. The best picture of 1989 was Rain Man. And Tom Cruise just came out with a movie, I think Mission Impossible again, about fifth or sixth. And the top-rated TV shows in 1989 were with two people who haven't been doing so well lately. So, but anyway, that was a long time ago. But it was also the year that the gene for CF was discovered. This was a cover from Science Magazine reporting, Science Journal reporting the discovery of the CF gene. And this was obviously a huge landmark in CF. And it led to the idea that perhaps we could treat the underlying cause of CF. Since we knew the gene, it seemed very straightforward to do gene therapy. We could replace the gene in patients, have the normal gene work in the way it's supposed to, and then lead to potentially a cure for CF. Well, it wasn't as simple as straightforward as we thought it was going to be. This is small, you can't see it very well, but I brought it up here to highlight the number of gene therapy trials that were begun and finished. And this review that we published in about 5 years ago, and there have been subsequent more gene therapy trials, just highlights the number of studies using whether it was a viral vector or a non-viral vector. This is just ways to get the gene into the lung or the nose These were very early phase experimental attempts to see if you could actually get the gene into the airways. And suffice it to say that really nothing came to fruition. Nothing seemed to allow enough of the normal gene to be expressed to really make it a viable therapy at this point. Now, that being said, people are still working on this, and it's still something that is out there in the horizon as a potential cure, if you will. But you know, here we are 30 some years later from the discovery of the gene, and we still do not have a viable gene therapy. So as time passed and more of these trials did not show efficacy, people started wondering, well, are there other approaches that we can use to try to target the underlying defect? Now, when I showed you that slide with the treatments that we've been using over the years, one of the things to remember is that they're targeting the downstream or the complications of the gene. What we really want is something that targets the underlying defect, whether it's the gene or the mutant protein. And so targeting the underlying gene seemed not to be working very well. So then people's thinking evolved, like, well, maybe we can do something about the protein. And this is where I think the imagination of scientists and people at the foundation really comes into play. This was really a novel way to look at a treatment, a problem. This is something that had not really been attempted before. And so the CF Foundation had been funding a lot of basic science clinical research up until about the year 2000. And that had led to the discovery of the gene. A lot of work had been done to understand the pathophysiology and what drugs worked and didn't work, but nothing had come to fruition with respect to the underlying treatment for the underlying disease. Well, at this point, Bob Bell at the foundation decided that, well, you know, we needed to up the ante. And he embarked on a program subsequently called Venture Philanthropy. He was really the first person to really to take this to the next level. And what he thought was, well, if we really want to take our basic science findings, but ramp them up to translate them into actual therapies, we need to partner with industry. And this is a excerpt that I pulled out from a newspaper article. It was published in June of 2000, where I'll just read a little bit from it. I think sort of highlights what the idea was. So the CF Foundation is launching an industry approach to drug discovery that is unrivaled. The important science that CFF has funded over the years in university labs and medical centers has created new opportunities for therapies. To convert these opportunities quickly and efficiently into compounds that can be tested in the clinic requires skill sets, technologies, and expertise that are beyond the basic research lab. So this was sort of the background that allowed, that sort of reinforced this idea of providing seed money for nascent pharmaceutical companies to develop new therapies. This was the first grant to Aurora Biosciences, which eventually led to Vertex and some of the drugs we have available today. So this goes back 18 years where the first grant was given. So the goal is to develop CFTR therapies for every patient. That's, you know, we talk about moonshots, you know, the cancer moonshot, going to the moon. But in CF, the moonshot is developing therapies that we can use for every patient. To restore CFTR function in 100% of CF patients. So this is a journey I want to talk to you about, like where we started, how we're progressed, and what more we still have to do. And this will be the sort of the basic the meat of my talk, if you will. And I'm a vegetarian, so. So one of the things to understand how these therapies are being developed is to think about what's happening in CF. When you have CF with, say, your Delta F508 homozygous, for instance, which is the most common mutation, you have very little CFTR function, somewhere around 1% or so. Now, we have, you know, those patients have siblings who may be carriers. Now, CF carriers have not 100% CFTR function, some, you know, 50%, 60%, but they're phenotypically are fine. So the idea thinking about that and then other sort of manifestations of CFTR mutations, we don't have to restore CFTR function to 100%. We can restore it to above certain thresholds. We can have a really meaningful change in the clinical course of our patients. So we can get from 1% to 10% of normal, or 20%, or 50%. Those are all thresholds that would may potentially meaningfully change the outcome. And what I show you here, can you guys see that? So if you look at patients who have cystic fibrosis, pancreatic sufficient, those patients have about 10 to 15% of normal CFTR activity. They tend to have a milder course. People with atypical CF have CFTR activity, which is a little bit more, maybe closer to 40%. And then you have carriers whose function is around 50 to 60%. So we don't necessarily need to get 100% of CFTR activity to really have a meaningful change in the course of patients. But what do we understand about these mutations? There's, you know, I said there were 2,000. Can the same approach work for every mutation? So as people started thinking about this, we began to understand that these mutations can be grouped into certain classes. And the classes are based on what happens to the protein. And I'll just walk you through this quickly so you understand this idea of how certain drugs work for certain mutations but not other ones, which is a little bit complicated. You can see the little baby's a little confused about this mutation class. So normally, when you make a protein, you know, we start with our DNA. It's made into RNA. The RNA is what's used to make the protein. So there can be defects in each of these events. So in class one, which is usually indicated, if you see an X next to your mutation, that indicates a class one, and what that means is it's what's called a premature stop codon. In our DNA, we have certain signals that tell machinery, okay, this is the beginning of a gene and this is the end of a gene. And when you have a mutation that has an X designation, there's a premature signal that says, okay, you can stop now, and the full RNA is not made. And so you have a truncated RNA, and obviously you can't get a normal protein when you don't make a full RNA. Okay, that's a class one mutation. And that's associated with almost no or very little CFTR function, minimal function, if you will. I'll talk about that a little bit later. Class two mutations, of which Delta F508 is an example, it's the most common mutation. That's a mutation in which the RNA is made, the protein is also produced, but the protein, because of the mutation, is misfolded. This misfolding is recognized within the cell as an abnormal protein, so it gets degraded within the cell. And it, obviously, if it gets degraded within the cell, it's not going to be able to get to the cell membrane, which is where it needs to get to allow chloride to move back and forth. So those are class two mutations. Class three mutations, of which G551D is an example, is a mutation that leads to a protein that is made into an RNA, made into a protein, gets to the cell membrane. And once it gets to the cell membrane, its ability to open and close is compromised. Think of it as a partially open door. The mechanism that opens the door across the membrane is not working normally. And so you have very little of the chloride that's allowed to move back and forth. Collectively, class one, class three, and one, two, and three mutations tend to be associated with a more severe clinical course. Class four and class five mutations, sometimes referred to as residual function mutations, and I'll talk about that a little bit down the road, are mutations where in class four, the gate itself is not normal, it's narrower. And class five mutations are mutations where you have low abundance. There's not enough, the protein itself is normal, but there's just not enough of it based on the mutation. And more recently, class six and class seven mutations have been described, which are very rare. Class six refers to mutations which the protein gets into the membrane, but it is prematurely degraded once it gets there. So its activity in the membrane is reduced because it doesn't hang around in the membrane very, very long. Now this is a simplistic description of these mutations. And you can have one mutation, it could demonstrate different aspects of it. So for example, class two, the Delta F5 mutation, probably fits into a class two and a class three, as we've learned over time. And that's, and what this means from a therapeutic perspective is that maybe one drug won't necessarily work for a specific mutation. You may need multiple approaches because it has multiple defects. This is kind of complicated, but I think it's useful to go through to understand why certain drugs work for certain mutations and not others. A simpler way to understand it is that the mutations, either there's not enough of it being made, like class one or class two, it doesn't get to the membrane, or that the protein does get to the cell membrane, but it doesn't open and close normally. So we want to talk about reduced quantity at the cell surface, or reduced function once it gets to the cell surface. That may be an easier way to understand these mutations. So the first class of drugs that were developed were potentiators and correctors. And I'm not going to go too much into how they were developed, but suffice it to say it took many years, millions and millions of dollars, to identify drugs that could work with these various mutations. And there's a whole nomenclature that's come out of this to describe how these drugs or what these drugs are actually doing. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is a class of drugs called potentiators. Ivacaftor is an example of a potentiator. And the way these drugs are working is that they can take a mutant protein that doesn't function properly as a gate, bind to the abnormal protein, and allow it to open more efficiently and for a longer period of time. So that's a potentiator. And it works very quickly in the laboratory if you test it in the lab. Correctors are drugs that can bind to a protein that's in the cell, and it helps to fold it in a more normal fashion. Remember, delta F508 is an example of a protein that doesn't quite make it to the membrane. It's because its folding structure, and we think about these things as linear molecules, but they're actually 3D structures. And the structure has to be appropriate for it to get to the cell membrane. And the correctors bind to this mutant protein and help it to get into a more normal 3D structure so it can actually get to where it needs to get to. And lumacaftor and tezacaftor are examples of correctors of CFTR mutations. So the first drug that was approved was ivacaftor. And this is now, it's hard to believe that these studies were done about 7 or 8 years ago. This seems, when we were going through the trials, we couldn't believe how patients were feeling on this medication. It would seem like a miracle. And it's hard to imagine, like, these were almost 7, 8 years ago now. But this is the data that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2011, describing the effect of ivacaftor in patients who had the G551D mutation. And it's really a remarkable result for a couple of different reasons. First of all, and what I'm showing you here is the study over 48 weeks. And what I'm showing on the y-axis is a change in your lung function, your FEV1, which is what we use to assess lung function. Now, this study was in patients who were over the age of 12. The way drug development works is that when you have a novel therapy, you start with patients generally who are over the age of 12 for a pivotal study, because we want to establish safety and efficacy of a new medication before we start treating younger patients with it. So this was only in patients who were over the age of 12. And what was remarkable was that you had, within two weeks, think about that, an FEV1 improvement of 10%. You almost never see that in pulmonary medicine. Something that improves your lung function, an absolute improvement in 10%. And also remarkably, it stayed above 10% from their baseline for the next 48 weeks. And I can tell you, patients felt really much better. They said, I could take a deep breath for the first time. They would describe, I could smell. I mean, it was just remarkable how they were feeling. I don't show you on this slide, but there were fewer exacerbations. You know, exacerbations are very morbid events. People were spending less time in the hospital, less time needing extra antibiotics. It was really, really remarkable. They put on weight, improved their nutritional status. So it was really, really a remarkable result. Equally remarkable was what happened to the sweat chloride. Now, you know, sweat chloride is our diagnostic test for CF generally. We also do gene mutations. And we use a cutoff of 60 millimoles per liter. You have to remember that, but just remember the number 60. That's the amount of chloride in your sweat. And in CF, because you can't reabsorb chloride, the chloride content of the sweat is increased, and that's why people tend to get dehydrated. Well, when these patients took this ivacaftor, their sweat chloride went from 100 to 50. Think about that. 60 is our cutoff. It went from 100 to 50. So now they're below the diagnostic threshold for CF. So if you had a patient that you didn't know had CF and was on ivacaftor, you do a sweat chloride, come back as 50, like, well, I'm not sure if you have CF or not. You know, you're below the diagnostic threshold. It was that remarkable. And as you would expect, it was consistent throughout the subsequent 48 weeks. So this is the study that led to the approval of ivacaftor as a first CFTR modulating therapy. But you know, that's a wonderful results. We really, you know, are heartened by them. But what we really want to know is what happens over the long term, right? I mean, if at the end of the day, what you get is an improvement for 48 weeks, but then things go back to the way they were, that's something, but it's not exactly what we're looking for. So one of the things that we've been following and trying to understand is what is happening when patients are treated with this approach over the long term. And there's now, as time has gone, some accumulating data about what's happening on the shorter to medium to longer term patients treated with ivacaftor. And I'm showing you a study that was published about 3 years ago that looked at what's called FEV1 decline. FEV1 decline refers to this idea that we all lose lung function over time. Some people lose it more quickly. Some people lose it more slowly. I mean, even if you don't have CF, our pulmonary function declines over as we get older. It's like anything else. But in CF patients, they lose it at a faster rate. So one of the things we want to understand is, are these drugs actually changing how quickly you're losing your lung function over time? In other words, are we taking the loss of lung function and getting it back towards a normal rate of loss? So this study looked at that. Now, these drugs work so well that it was really, when you do a study, you always want to compare it to not the same group of patients if you hadn't gotten the medication. But because these drugs so well, it really isn't ethical to not treat patients who have G5OND with ivacaftor. So we did kind of a workaround, if you will. So we compared patients who were on ivacaftor to patients who were in the CFF registry where had delta F508 homozygous. What we had understand before was that they had similar clinical courses. We thought it'd be okay to compare the group. And at that time, there was no medications approved for delta F508. And so we wanted to see what happened to lung function decline over that period of time. And what they found was there was almost a 47% reduction or attenuation in FEV1 decline. In other words, your rate of loss was reduced. So you're maintaining your lung function for a longer period of time. So this was data suggesting that not only are we getting an improvement initially, but we're not losing it over time as quickly. That makes sense? Which was something that we really wanted to see. But in some ways, that's a bit like apples and oranges, because you're not comparing the same patient type. So what do we know about when you look at patients who are, when you do apples to apples kind of comparison? And so the only way to look at that is to look at patients before they started ivacaftor and see what happens to their FEV1 and compare it to after they start ivacaftor and see if you are changing it. So we published a study earlier this year. And in part, we started doing this because we were getting some pushback from payers about, well, is your patient responding to ivacaftor? How do we know they're going to benefit? And so we looked at patients who are in this GOAL study, which is a study that's looking at patients on ivacaftor and longer term outcomes. What we wanted to see was, well, some people respond very well in the short term, other people don't respond as well. Can we say anything about their longer term outcomes between those two different cohorts? So the study was, everyone's on ivacaftor, some people responded well, some people didn't respond well. What happens over the next 2 years? And what we showed was that whether you were a responder or not a responder, and this was based on how much your FEV1 improved in the first 4 weeks. So what we showed was that whether you responded in the first 4 weeks or not, your exacerbation rate was reduced in each cohort, meaning that whether you showed a short-term response or not, you had a longer-term benefit from ivacaftor. Yes?
Was the sweat chloride drop the same in both groups?
Yes. There was no difference in sweat chloride. And I think it's an important question to bring up. You know, why is there a disconnect between the sweat chloride and the FEV1? Well, the sweat chloride reflects CFTR function directly. FEV1 is impacted by CFTR function, but it's also impacted by other factors that may not be impacted by ivacaftor. So it's a more complex endpoint. But then we also looked at FEV1 decline over 2 years and showed that whether you were a responder or non-responder, both groups of patients had attenuation in their FEV1 declines. So this was an apples-to-apples comparison, that prior to starting ivacaftor, you had a certain FEV1 decline, and it changed once you started on ivacaftor. So we think that this is really impacting not just the short-term, but the medium-term outcomes. It'd be important to see what happens in 5 years, 7 years down the road. Because what we think will happen is that if you attenuate FEV1 decline, you can have improvement in mortality and other important long-term outcomes. What I've shown you is sort of an idealized graph. So in the red line is if you had the FEV1 decline that we would normally expect, and then if you were G550 with ivacaftor, if you attenuate it, you can see that by the point you get to FEV1 of 25% of predicted, you're much, much, much older. And that assumes that you started it at birth. But if you started even later in life, say in your mid-20s, you can see that you can push out the need for a lung transplant to many, many years. So we think that this will eventually translate into less of a need for lung transplant and improve mortality. And we're actually starting to accumulate some data on that as well. So this was a study published earlier this year. And what they did in this particular study was look at patients in the US registry and the UK registry. And they looked at patients treated with ivacaftor and compared it to patients not on ivacaftor. So it was not G551D patients, but it was patients who were similar in terms of clinical severity, but not on any CFTR modulator. And this is looking at death and the need for transplantation. And what I want to point out to you is the relative risk, which is the second line from the bottom. So in patients who were treated with ivacaftor, the risk of death was reduced by over 50% in the 2 years that they did this study. And the need for organ transplant was reduced by 85% in the group that got ivacaftor. Similarly, in the UK registry, they also saw a reduced need for lung transplantation and reduced mortality. So this is early data, and then we don't have a lot of events here in terms of death and transplant, but this is accumulating data, and it's all very consistent that we're starting to change the long-term outcomes for patients treated with ivacaftor. Thank you so much. So I want to point this out, 0.41, 0.15. So this all suggests that the longer-term outcomes for these patients are improving. This is something that, you know, we'll pay attention to as we go forward, but it is kind of encouraging. So at the end of the day, we have ivacaftor, works really well short-term, long-term, medium-term, long-term. But again, that addresses about 4% of the population. It's a relatively, it's great therapy for those patients who have that particular mutation, but we still have a lot of work to do if our goal is restoration of 100% of our patients. Well, as it turns out that there are other gating mutations. This is a class 3 mutation, G551D. And there are other mutations which happen less frequently, but combined probably address another 2 or 3% of patients in MAS. And so a study was done to look at these patients and the genotypes listed here. And again, we see similar kind of effects with the treatment of ivacaftor. You have a nice increase in pulmonary function within a couple of weeks, and it stays above baseline for 8 weeks. So this was important because it suggested that class 3 mutations were amenable to this kind of approach. So if you are newly diagnosed and you have a class 3 mutation, ivacaftor would definitely be an option for you, whether it was G5OND or one of these other ones. But the real power of this approach, you know, I think lies in not just treating what has happened already, but maybe preventing the complications, development of bronchiectasis, malnutrition, diabetes, Pseudomonas infection. So to approach that, we need to start this treatment probably at a younger age. But as I alluded to earlier, you know, we need to understand whether it's safe to use this drug in younger patients before we can actually do it in a widespread fashion. So now in the last couple of years, people have actually published studies looking at patients very young treated with ivacaftor. So this is a study in patients aged 2 to 5 who have the class 3 or gating mutations. Now patients who are 2 to 5 can't do pulmonary function. They can't do a pulmonary maneuver. So we can't look at that kind of data, and generally their pulmonary function, if we could do it, it's probably going to be normal, so it may not be very informative in terms of whether a drug is working or not working. But we can't see what's happening to sweat chloride. And what we saw in these patients who were age 2 to 5, we saw a very similar drop in sweat chloride as we saw in the adult, in the older kids population, suggesting that it works just as well in terms of improving CFTR function in the younger cohort as older patients. The other aspect of this is it was, you know, is it safe? And I don't show the data here, but I can tell you that it was very well tolerated by the 2 to 5-year-olds. You have to keep an eye on the liver function test as we do for the older patients, but almost no patient had to stop the drug prematurely because of side effects or adverse events. So this was a very heartening to see that it was safe. Well, but you know, most of our patients get diagnosed before the age of 2 with newborn screening. Yes, sorry. Before you get to phase 3 studies, you do phase 1, phase 2, where they do dose exploration. And so what you're balancing is getting the dose that is efficacious with higher doses that might be toxic and not get much more of a benefit. And so by the time you get to a phase 3 study, you've decided the balance between efficacy and side effects or toxicity is in that range. So for these kids, the doses was lower than what we use in adults, but the concentrations they were able to get in their blood was similar that we saw with the adult population. So it's not as simple, unfortunately, as more is better. It's got to be, it's like Goldilocks, you got to have the right amount. Yeah. I can hear you.
Okay. You mentioned watching the liver function, and I was wondering if there's somewhere where I could read more about the data around how the children's liver function was monitored. Is it in the study?
It's in the study. If you pull it up, there's usually supplements to these studies that get into more detail about the liver functions and. Okay, I'll get through it. I'm sorry, was there another question? Okay, so, and just recently, a study was published and looked at patients, babies, 12 to 24 months of age. And again, showed that it was safe, well tolerated by the infants. And even remarkably, had almost a 70 millimole drop in their sweat chloride. So we are not far from potentially starting ivacaftor in class 3 patients at the time of diagnosis potentially, which is remarkable. So to move on to other gene mutations and classes, now class 4 and class 5, remember, are mutations which we refer to sometimes as residual function, and collectively they represent about 10% of all CF patients. The most common mutation is R117H, and remember, in class 4 mutations, the protein is actually in the membrane, but it doesn't. The gate itself doesn't open normally, or it's narrower. And this is a study that was published about 3 or 4 years ago. And again, you can see that when these R117H patients were treated with ivacaftor, you had about a 6% improvement in FEV1. And then when they stopped it, the lung function went back to baseline. And then when they restarted the drug, it went back up. When you see this on, off, on phenomena, it suggests that the drug is actually doing something, because the improvement in the fall lung function correlates by starting and stopping the medication. So this particular study was what was used to approve R117H for CF patients. And then, very interestingly, in a sort of a landmark kind of decision for the FDA, a whole host of other mutations were approved based on testing in the laboratory. Now, the reason we had to do this is because a lot of these mutations happen very infrequently, relatively speaking. And it's really hard to collect enough patients with a specific mutation to do a randomized study like we do for G551D or Delta F patients. And so what the FDA did was use data from a laboratory. And what's done in the laboratory is you take these FRT cells for some reason, these cells really are good at taking in foreign DNA, mutant DNA, which then expresses a protein, and then you can test various drugs in the laboratory to see if chloride movement occurs. And so you could take whatever mutation you have, put it into these cells, and test your drug. And that's what they did. This was a publication by Fred Van Gore about 4 years ago, and he tested a host of mutations, which are listed here. It's too small for you to see. But the bottom line is, a bunch of these, the dark represents chloride movement without ivacaftor. The white represents what happens when you add ivacaftor. And you can see that all these mutations had a significant improvement in chloride movement when you gave ivacaftor. And that's the data that was used to gain approval for these other mutations for ivacaftor. This is one of the only examples that I know of where you could use testing in a laboratory to get approval for clinical use. Now, that's based on the background that we knew ivacaftor works really well already in other patients. It's generally pretty safe. And so it is not like FDA is going to start approving medications for based on laboratory testing. But based on this background and this the data, they led to improvement of ivacaftor. So where are we now on this journey to the moon? All right, so we have ivacaftor. It's approved for G551D patients, a number of other gating mutations, R117H, and residual function mutations. So collectively, we're getting to about 12% 12% effective therapy of CFTR function. Still a long way to go. And the big problem is the Delta F508 patients. So, as I alluded to earlier, Delta F508 mutants that mutation is particularly hard to treat because it has multitude of defects. It's not just you take one medication, you can fix the whole defective protein. And so what we learned in the laboratory was that you need a combination of medications, a potentiator, which works within seconds, and correctors to adequately address this particular mutation. So there had been previous work that had showed that ivacaftor didn't work, lumacaftor didn't work by themselves, but if you combine them, that perhaps you had enough efficacy to have clinical benefit. And this is a study that was published the data came out about 2.5 years ago, but it was published a year ago. What it showed was patients who were treated with the combination of lumacaftor-ivacaftor had, again, within 2 weeks, an improvement in pulmonary function, which remained out to almost well, out to a year and almost 2 years. Also of note is that patients who initially were not treated with Lumacaftor, Ivacaftor, when they got switched over, they also had a nice improvement in their pulmonary function. This is important because when you see this kind of effect replicated in the placebo group, that means that we really think this drug is working the way it's supposed to be working. Now, the magnitude of effect isn't what we were hoping for. It was about a little under 3% improvement in FEV1, which you contrast Ivacaftor, was about 10-11%, so not quite what we were hoping to see. And so on the back of Lumacaftor, Ivacaftor was a second combination of Tezacaftor and Ivacaftor, which was also developed and has been tested and approved now. It was approved in February of this year. And I've shown you a comparison between these two combinations, which are both indicated for Delta F508 patients. And you can see that the relative improvement in FEV1 was 2.8% versus 4. The BMI changes, a comparison. Both lead to fewer exacerbations, about a little over a third fewer exacerbations with each of those medications. In terms of how patients feel, the CFQR is a symptom score, and patients seem to feel a little bit better with the Tezacaftor-Ivacaftor combination. One of the issues that came up with Lumacaftor-Ivacaftor was that patients were getting a lot of chest symptoms, chest tightness, wheezing, congestion, which may have impacted the CFQR. And there was a higher dropout rate. So generally, it seems that the Lumacaftor-Ivacaftor is not as well tolerated as a Tez-Iva combination. So those are some of the similarities and differences between the two combinations. The other thing to note about this combination is that there is a lot of drug-drug interactions with Lumacaftor that limits its ability to be used with certain other medications we use for CF patients. There's less of that with the Tezacaftor-Ivacaftor combination. In addition, this combination is also approved for 22 other mutations, predominantly the class 4, class 5 mutations, whereas for this for Lumacaftor-Ivacaftor, this is the only mutation it's approved for. And importantly, as we talk about the triple combination, that triple combination will be on the backbone of these two drugs. So down the road, if we think about triple as a potential treatment, it'll be in the backbone of Tezacaftor, Ivacaftor. So those are the short-term responses. Again, going back to what we want to see in terms of longer-term effects, this was a study published last year looking at what happens to FEV1 decline with the combination of Lumacaftor-Ivacaftor, and compared it to patients who were not treated. And this is more of an apples-to-apples comparison because they were all Delta F patients. And you can see there was about a 42% attenuation of FEV1 decline. So we're slowing the rate of worsening lung function. You get the nice initial improvement, and then maybe the fall in lung function is not as quick as it is if you were not on Lumacaftor-Ivacaftor. So again, we're going to have to wait a longer period of time to see its effects on lung transplantation and mortality, but this is suggestive that may have impact on that as well with time. So we have a combination now for Delta F508 patients, which represents about almost 50%. So we're getting up close to 60% efficacy. But there's still about 40% of patients we still don't have an option for. The vast majority of the remaining 40% are patients who are what we call the het-mins. They have one Delta F508 mutation, and the second mutation is associated with very minimal function. So those are the patients we really have to target next. And the idea behind helping those patients comes from this idea of a second corrector. So as I alluded to earlier, the Delta F mutation is a complicated mutation. We had a combination of a corrector and a potentiator to get the initial efficacy. But as time passed and more work was done in the laboratory, we realized that maybe you need more than one corrector, that the folding defect is not completely addressed by one corrector. Perhaps you needed to add a second corrector to get adequate recovery of CFTR function. This is data from the laboratory, which is showing you the percent restoration of chloride transport relative to normal. You'd want 100% would be normal. And you can see that in Delta F homozygous patients, the combination of Lumacaftor-Ivacaftor gets you to about 30%. But if you're this sort of het-min person, patient, you only get about 10 or 15% restoration. That's not enough to see a clinical benefit. But when you add a second corrector, you get almost a 55, 60% improvement in the Delta F patients. And for the Het Min patients with a second corrector, you get up to about 30%. And we would predict that this would be associated with clinical benefit. So that was the idea behind this triple combination that is being tested presently in our CF centers. Now, to tell you about the program, there were four, when we did, there were four compounds that were tested in the phase two studies. This data has not been published yet. It's just been released as press releases, but they all seem to have efficacy that was present in the Delta, the Het Min patients, as well as the Delta F patients. And out of those four compounds, two have been selected to go into phase three studies, and those studies are ongoing now. And what I'm showing you is that one drug is called VX659, and one drug is called VX445. Both of these are the sort of the second correctors. Patients are also being treated with tezacaftor and ivacaftor, and then this is being added to that. And the phase two study suggested efficacy and safety. So what I'm showing you here is patients who were had one mutation, Delta F, another minimal function mutation, and after they were treated with this triple combination, they had almost a 10% improvement in FEV1 in the phase two studies. And the sweat chloride, as I'm showing you here, was falling about almost 40 millimoles per liter fall in sweat chloride. It's sort of in the ballpark what we saw with ivacaftor in the G551D patients. So based on this phase two data, there are parallel phase three studies ongoing in patients over the age of 12 who are Het Min's or Delta F homozygotes, and they will be eligible to go into an open label extension, which will probably go out for 96 weeks. And we expect to see data on this in the next early part of next year to see if there was adequate safety and efficacy to put forth with a FDA approval. So this is really exciting, and I would urge you to keep an eye out for this. As it happens, most of this information comes out in press releases nowadays before they actually come out in medical journals, so keep an eye out for press releases. So one of the things that is noteworthy is that we talk about mean effects of these drugs, but you know, these mean effects represent, you know, tens and hundreds of patients' individual effects. And not every patient has exactly 10% improvement. Some people may have, you know, 15% improvement. Some others may have one or no improvement. And so if you have a patient, you want to know, is this going to work for me, right? And it's not clear from my perspective that the same triple combination is going to work well for patient A, patient B, patient C. In other words, different people may benefit from different triple combinations. So it's really important to think about other potential ways to treat these patients. And I'll talk a little bit about other triples that are being developed that may be options down the road. But another idea that has come to fruition is this idea of CFTR amplification, which is very interesting. The idea here is that you have mutant protein that can be worked upon by our modulators. But what if you had more protein, even though it's mutant, you just had more of it, then you'd have these drugs that could work on more of the mutant protein. And this is the idea behind CFTR amplification. There's a company called Proteostasis that developed this compound called PTI-428. The idea behind this compound is that it helps the mRNA more efficiently translate into a protein when it binds to this structure in the cell called the ribosome, such that for a given RNA, you have more protein that's being made. If more protein is made, there's more substrate for the other drugs to work upon. And so how well does it work? Well, this is, again, press release, published or released later part of this year. Results in the study was done in patients who were already in Orkambi. So they were on Orkambi, a stable dose, and then this drug was added to them. And you can see that in the purple, you show the effects in patients who got the drug versus placebo. And many more patients who got the drug had an improvement in FEV1. Some of these folks had a greater than 10% improvement in FEV1 when this PTI 428 was added to a background of Orkambi, and really none of the placebo patients had much of an effect. Now, this is a phase two study, and so we'll have to wait for bigger results, a bigger study to see whether there is, and this holds true in a larger study. But this idea that there may be a way to amplify the effect of Orkambi or Symdeko by using this approach is really interesting. And the other nice thing about it is it's potentially genotype independent. It doesn't matter what your gene mutation is. It could work for whatever it is, just increasing the RNA, if you will. So now with the potential for the triple combination, we have the possibility that 90% of our patients will be have therapeutic options. Now, I want to just talk a little bit about this idea about heterogeneity in clinical response. Not everyone benefits equally from these drugs. And this is demonstrating that particular point. This is a study that was published from Germany earlier this year, in which they took patients who were Delta F508 treated with Lumacaftor, Ivacaftor, and then they looked to see what their pulmonary function did. And you can see there's this distribution of what happened to their FEV1. Some people had a really nice response over here, but some people had minimal or no response, and some people actually lost pulmonary function. So while we think about these mean effects, there are patients who may not respond very well to this. And so for those folks, we really need other options potentially if this doesn't work for them. And so there's two other compounds that are being tested that I think you should be aware of. Both of these compounds went through a phase two testing. And the studies were adding this compound, GLPG-2737, on a background of Orkambi. And when these patients had this added to Orkambi, they had almost a 20 millimole fall in their sweat chloride and improvement in FEV1 of about 3.4%, so some added benefit. And again, Proteostasis has a corrector compound which was added to Orkambi, and they had about a 16 millimole drop in sweat chloride and a minimal improvement in FEV1. And both of these corporations are planning a triple combo trial of their own to see what efficacy they can may be able to get. The take home from this is that it's important for us to have options, that we have the ability to pick and choose different combinations that would work for different people. It's not a situation where one size is going to fit all, I think. And one of the challenges is going to be to figure out how to pick the right combination for a given individual. And we have some data accumulating on that as well. So this is a study that I want to. It's kind of interesting from the perspective of using a laboratory testing to actually select drugs for a particular patient. So what they did in this study was they actually took cells, they did biopsies from the rectum, and grew these cells into what's called an organoid, these like circular structures. And they grew them in the laboratory, and they exposed them to, in this particular case, a combination of 809, 770, or Lumacaftor, Ivacaftor. And if the compounds have the ability to activate CFTR in a very efficient way, these things tend to swell up because water and chloride and sodium move into the organoid. And you can quantify this and say, well, CFTR function was restored to 20%, 30%, 40%. And if you can measure that, the question is, can that predict in any meaningful way what the clinical response to the patient is going to be? So you take these cells from a patient, test them in the laboratory, see what kind of effect they get for the different compound, and does that tell us? If you want to think down the road, you could test different combinations of drugs and see which one gives you the best effect, and then pick that particular combination for your patient. That's where the power of this might come through. And what they showed in this study is that the FEV1 improvement in patients was related to how much CFTR function they could rescue in the laboratory. So a test in the lab could actually tell you what was going to happen clinically for an individual, not just a population of patients. There are other ways to assess CFTR function. Obviously, sweat chloride And then you can also measure nasal potential differences, and then this is a test to assess chloride current movement in rectal biopsies. And this was the same study that I just alluded to earlier, where there was a heterogeneity in FEV1. And at this point, we don't have a very accurate way of predicting clinical response based on this study that these three different ways to assess CFTR function in the patient did not have a very good predictive response of who would get the most benefit for FEV1. So there's still some work that needs to be done with respect to having a very robust ability, but this is, I think, where the future might be in terms of selecting the appropriate medications for patients. Okay, so so we restore CFTR function in almost 90% of patients, but that still leaves about 10% of patients who don't potentially don't have options at this point. So what is happening with them? Well, just earlier this this year, the CF Foundation announced this initiative called RARE to study people who have two premature stop codons. These are patients who don't have a protein that can be rescued very easily. And so the foundation is embarking on this initiative to understand how these patients can be approached and what they can be treated with. And there are six sites around the country. Stanford is one of them. And the idea here is to develop modulator therapies and read-through agents for these particular kinds of patients. And so this study is just sort of getting off the ground, and we're collecting cells and biopsies from patients, and they'll be tested in the laboratory to see whether compounds that are available now or new compounds that are being developed might be options for those 10% of patients. And the idea is similar to what I alluded to earlier, where you can take cells from a given patient, the mutant DNA, put it into these FRT cells, grow them up in the laboratory, and test various compounds and see whether you can get CFTR rescue. And if you see something like this with a compound, it doesn't have to be avacaftor, it could be any compound. If you see this, that could represent a potential option for those patients. So so there's work being done to address patients who have relatively rare, non-rescuable mutations. And it, just as I wrap up here in the last couple of minutes, I wanted to just paint the future. You know, these drugs, these approaches are going to modify the disease, but they are not necessarily cures in the sense that they will permanently fix the underlying defect in CF. But there are approaches which are looking at that as cures. And so I've just sort of highlighted them here. Gene editing using CRISPR technology. I'm sure if you read the paper, you hear about CRISPR in many different contexts. But the idea, the potential exists that you could use CRISPR technology to actually edit or correct the gene itself. We're still a ways away from that. For patients who have nonsense, these premature stop codons, there are drugs being developed that will improve read-through a stop codon. These are in phase one and phase two studies, so keep an eye out for that. And then there are obviously mutation-independent approaches, whether it's gene therapy using adeno-associated virus or nanoparticles, CFTR mRNA delivery. There's a study about we're about to start with a few other centers called Translate Bio, which use nanoparticles to deliver normal CFTR mRNA to the airways. And then stem cells is a potential therapeutic option as well. And you know, we have a lot of people who still, you know, have advanced lung disease and still need other approaches to deal with inflammatory injury and infection. So there's many studies still ongoing to look at novel anti-inflammatory approaches. These are just four different compounds that are in phase two or phase one studies that are coming to the TDN, which we'll be looking at, which will give us novel anti-inflammatory approaches. And then antibiotics, obviously a key part of managing CF patients. And so there's an ongoing study of nebulized vancomycin, which will target MRSA. fostamycin, tobramycin combination, which could address both Pseudomonas and MRSA. Gallium, which is interesting, it's an iron mimetic. It fools the bacteria into thinking that it's iron. Iron is required for bacterial metabolism, but it can't metabolize gallium, so it basically serves as a metabolic poison. It's being developed for Pseudomonas or aeruginosa infections and NTM infections. Inhaled nitric oxide and ALX-009, which will target these various bacteria, including B. sepatia and fungal infections. So this is just a sort of a summary of different compounds and molecules that are being developed, just to give you a breadth of what might be coming down the road in terms of treatment options for our patients. And lastly, I want to talk about lung transplantation. Unfortunately, a few of our patients do need a lung transplant, and this has been something that's been recognized by the foundation as something that we need to work on. And so now there is a consortium of transplant centers around within CF community that have been set up and developed to understand the relationship between CF and lung transplants. Survival benefit. Patients with CF who get lung transplant tend to do better than in all other indications. Adults are probably do better than children. There's not been a survival benefit shown for children, and prior surgery is not a contraindication. So this collaborative that has been set up is a few centers around the country, and this is a listing here of the centers that are participating in this lung transplant consortium. And their main goal is to right now is to set up four working groups. And one of the things we want to set up with that is, you know, what are the best referral practices in terms of when to refer patients for lung transplant? What's the what in terms of timing and other considerations? How to manage them post transplant? What centers and how CF care should be delivered post transplant? Guidelines for when patients have advanced lung disease, and obviously research questions related to lung transplantation. So this is all taking off the ground right now. We should gain a lot more information about how to optimally manage lung transplantation. To summarize, we've come a long way, but we still have a ways to go. So I think we're in the midst of our journey. We have three compounds that are approved right now, which are helping our patients clinically, but there's several more small molecules down the road, which I think will continue to improve our patients' lives. We have the possibility of personalizing CF care modulators down the road, picking the right, mixing and matching the right medications for our patients. Even difficult to rescue mutations might be addressable. Cures are probably a little further down the road, but it's still a goal. And then we have novel anti-inflammatory, anti-infectives, which may optimize a management of infection and inflammation, and then lung transplantation once we get to a certain point in CF lung disease. With that, I'll stop and thank you for your attention and take any questions. Thank you.